Amy, welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul. My pleasure.
So my guest today is Amy Butcher, who is a writer and a creative writing teacher, and just came out with a book that I plowed through, Mother Trucker. And this is actually, we meet by way of algorithm, so you know. I was looking on my book to see which books were cross-referencing, and your name popped up, and I said, oh, that's an interesting book. And I looked at it, and I hadn't heard of you before, and I said, wow, she'd be an interesting person to talk to. So that's how we got connected.
I love it. My pleasure. I'm so happy to be here.
The podcast is really about big life lessons that we learn by living, and your book has a ton of that in it. For people who aren't familiar with you or your writing or Mother Trucker, why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit to them?
Absolutely. So I'm a writer and I direct the creative writing program at Ohio Wesleyan University, where I teach classes, specifically creative writing workshops. The book that I just published, Mother Trucker, besides having, I think, my favorite name that I'll ever publish a book with, it's largely sort of a hybrid work. On the one hand, it profiles a woman by the name of Joy Ruth Wiebe, who for 13 years was Alaska's only big 18-wheeler haul road truck driver on the James W. Dalton Highway, which is this 414-mile long road that moves from Fairbanks, Alaska, all the way through northern Arctic Alaska and to the oil fields of Prudhoe Bay and the industrial complex of Dead Horse. I found her on Instagram, absolutely captivated. She went by the Instagram handle Alaska Mother Trucker, and her trucking handle was Mother Trucker, which I absolutely loved. And she was this petite 50-year-old woman, just fearless, you know, navigating one of the most dangerous roads in the world, and also a road that's been called the loneliest and the most isolated road in America. So as a writer, I'm always looking for interesting subjects, and Joy seemed like that to a T. But the book also sort of blends aspects of memoir in the sense that upon flying north to meet Joy and write about her, our conversations began to lead us to similar points of experience, largely rooted in what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a woman more specifically as part of an abusive partnership. And unfortunately, so many of the reasons that I was attracted to Joy, her strength, the idea that she navigated an enormous vehicle on this deadly stretch of road, most of those were out of pleasure, yes, but also out of necessity. And at the time, I was also navigating an abusive partnership, was not yet comfortable kind of calling it that. And so a lot of the book explores what it is to be indeed a strong woman in America and what makes women often have to make these really necessary decisions.
There are all sorts of topics I want to jump into: the violence against women, self-reliance, the internet, the reality versus it is, the durability and fragility of love. There's a lot about religion here that's quite economic shifts. And of course, the end of the book, loss. Can you get just back up a second before you become this writer and sort of going there? There's a little bit about it in the book, but not much. Like, where did you grow up? Who are mom and dad? How does a person become a creative writer?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I was sort of a naturalist kind of kid. I grew up in the countryside outside of Philadelphia. So I was raised really out in the open. We had a lot of land that as a kid I would explore. So self-reliance was really integral. There, out of necessity, there really were no other kids around to play with. I had two brothers, was raised very much a tomboy out, you know, creating BMX bike jumps, catching crayfish in the creek, really sort of rural upbringing, but also loved to read and increasingly loved to write. Reading and writing was largely my means of escape. It was also something to do simply to pass the time. My parents came from pretty different backgrounds and ways. My dad was a scientist, worked for a pharmaceutical company, basically creating medicines and vaccines. And my mother was more of the humanities base. She was a foreign language teacher who at one point in time taught Latin, Spanish, and French in the public school system. So I was really raised by intellectually curious people. They really valued education. I'm really lucky in that regard. And there was never sort of an absence of books and literature growing up. I think increasingly, in a lot of ways, I think what we end up doing chooses us, in the sense that I know from an early age, writing was my way to pass the time. It was my way to explore things without immediate peers around. And it was something that, you know, teachers said that I was good at, which means everything, right? When you're young, let's continue to do the thing that earns me some praise. And so I think that's sort of how my early writing kind of led to a life carved around writing.
One thing I've definitely found speaking with and a whole range of people listening to this podcast is the notion of lack of distraction. And then what's shifted now, and maybe we'll start a little bit with that with the book. So I thought it was interesting that your window onto Joy was initially through the internet, and you sort of unfold this gradually, but you're struggling in a relationship. and you're sort of cruising this thing. And I think that the internet, all these apps are happening so quickly. My suspicion is we ourselves don't quite understand them. Like now in retrospect, we can understand radio and TV really well because it's kind of slowed down. And sort of when I was growing up, TV was the big evil. Like you had to limit how long people watch it. Like no children watch TV now, as far as I'm concerned. But there is definitely this aspect of these apps that are escapism. And that yours takes a particular breed, which is you have this guy who you call the book Dave, who initially seems very gentle and loving, but then it kind of turns and kind of warped in scary ways. And then take us in. So you're looking at the internet, you stumble on this. What was so appealing about the images, the poll there?
Yeah, I mean, joy seemed to represent everything that I did not have and did not feel. I mean, you know, I'm an educated person. I know that social media is performative, right? I was willingly a part of this. I had an Instagram that I curated. I talk about this in the book, like so many other individuals. Like, here's the nice thing, my boyfriend, again, in the book, I call him Dave. Here's the nice thing that he built me. You know, he liked to build furniture, for example. He was constantly surprising me with these, what my friends would call grand gestures. I mean, all of that was something to document because it made me feel good about myself. It made me feel as though I had control in a situation that increasingly was volatile and that I felt stripped of control. But for joy, I mean, you know, I'm idly scrolling. Instagram, like so many social media platforms, has this explore feature where you hit a button and suddenly, you know, the whole feed is populated with little square images of things completely outside. And I know now it's an algorithm, right?
Indeed it is. Created by a lot of, interestingly enough, you know, my son works in the tech field, by like kind of emotionally numb people. So it's weird that they have all this emotional resonance with us, but.
Totally. Absolutely. But here suddenly, you know, the first photo I saw, I volunteer a lot for rescue organizations for animals, and I'm a big dog person. For better or worse, I've got three dogs. And here's this little, you know, white puppy wrapped in a blanket and a pink blanket. And I think like, oh, that's cute. Let me look. Let me see what that dog looks like. Right. And I suddenly realized like it's this handle Alaska Mother Trucker. And here's this super petite 50-year-old woman. And she's standing next to an enormous 18-wheeler in front of these enormous snow-covered mountains in northern Alaska. I think, again, I was at a point where I was looking for a project to commit myself to. I was largely writing sort of short opinion pieces or really short essays, but it had been a few years since I had a book. And, you know, as a writer, I'm always looking to what project can I throw myself into? What can I invest my time and energy? And, you know, looking at this woman, you know, from a selfish point, it was, I want to go to Alaska and I want to spend some time up there and I want to write about this woman. And this is my way of doing it. It was partially escapism in the sense that I felt deeply that I needed to put some space between my partner and I, because of the nature of our relationship. But also, I mean, from a purely pragmatic, you know, someone who loves life and adventure, like, let's commit myself to a project that takes me across the country into this really amazing landscape.
I thought about this as I was reading the book. In other words, if you saw your stereotypical log haul trucker in front of a big Alaskan truck, it would just sort of be, I suspect. And then the petite, who we later find mom of three, I guess. Totally different thing. Why do you think that is?
I think looking back, there were things that I was anticipating about Joy and her life experience that tied very neatly to things that I was interested in. I consider myself, for example, a feminist. I teach a class on contemporary feminist narratives. So I think there was that element that, like, I thought in choosing to write about Joy, I was angling myself into a book that explored a lot of different things. But I expected, and I talk about this in the book, I expected that for the most part, Joy would have stories of being disrespected, that overwhelmingly male-dominated industry would prove inhospitable to her. You know, I thought that's what I was sort of starting to set myself up for. And it was going to be sort of like a broader cultural examination of what it is to operate in what is still a very male-dominated space. But also, I mean, just from looking at her pictures and her photos, like, she was a hoot.
Right.
I mean, you know, she's taking pictures and captioning them with jokes about, you know, a golf cart being hauled up the Dalton Highway. Like, for what? Who's golfing in the Arctic? And so from that point of view, I also thought, like, okay, this woman, obviously, the story could have incredible moments of levity. You know, there's the naturalist aspect of it. I think, you know, I'm always trying to think of how can I tie a personal narrative, whether that's my own or someone else's, to a larger sort of cultural conversation. Right. So thinking about, you know, drilling in Anwar, right, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, thinking about the extraction of natural gas up in Alaska. I mean, there's just a lot of fodder that I could see this project opening up to speak to something beyond simply joy.
Right.
I also didn't anticipate quite how full and dimensional her lived experience really was.
Right.
So I think it was that combination of like, through this, I can extrapolate and engage in these larger conversations that I'm interested in.
So then you get up there and the story's more complex. One of the interesting things that I found there is that, you know, Joy is, I would describe her as a very dedicated Christian, a Trumpist.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main points of struggle, and maybe struggle is not the right word, danger between you and your partner is religion.
Absolutely.
It's working in two very different ways in your lives at the same time. You unpack that a little bit?
So I was raised in a really sort of atheist household. I mean, I in many ways feel super blessed because, you know, being an adult now, I have so many friends, especially I think living in the Midwest as I do now, that have some real scarring and damage from their cultural sort of religious upbringing. I mean, my parents, you know, as I said, a scientist and a foreign language teacher, both had been raised in faith traditions and both chose based on their life experiences to sort of walk away with it or walk away, excuse me, from it.
Mm.
And so my brothers and I were raised in a household where, you know, we lived in a town where everyone went to church except for us. And that was family time. Sunday was, you know, hiking and eating breakfast together and bonding in a way that had no religious ties. My partner, on the other hand, really a pretty gentle faith overall, but had sort of internalized so much shame and I think misogyny from the religion and had these ideas that I didn't realize at first were part of his moral fabric. I think when we first met, we were long distance. And so sure, you know, I would fly out to visit him and we would go to church. And that was something that I prided myself on. You know, this was 2018. So a couple of years after, you know, Trump's election. And when I met Joy, at that point, obviously it had hit a fever pitch, but things were sort of percolating in a divisive way in this nation. And I prided myself on the idea that, like, here is a partner who's different from me.
Mm.
That's okay. I can treat that with respect. I can sit in church with him. I can explore what faith might look like for me. What I didn't realize is to the extent that my partner was really banking on the fact that I would not only attend these church services with him, but wholly convert and convert to what was increasingly feeling like a fundamentalist version of his faith. You know, all of that was I've come to separate. And I think in the book, I work really hard to separate faith itself from individual people and ego, because Joy, when I first met her, the first thing she asked is if I want to go to church with her. And I did not. I mean, that was the last thing I wanted to do, because for, you know, almost 3 years, I'd been in this partnership where faith was this weapon and it had become this really sharp sort of instigator of stress and anxiety and ultimately abuse leveled at me by my partner. And so, you know, but as a writer, you're always saying, sure, you spend as much time with your subject as possible because you never know what might come of it. You want to be open, right? Especially when you first meet someone.
Yeah.
So Joy, you know, is presenting as this really religious person. That was an aspect of her that I worried about, but overwhelmingly, she embodied in many ways so much of what faith is striving for, right? Which is openness, which is compassion for other people. And she was a really complicated individual, even, you know, again, despite these dramatic differences between us, not only in faith, but voting, political sort of ideology, that sort of thing.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
The time with her that blended with what you're growing up with, how did it change with distance what you thought about Dave? Because it seemed, I mean, from my perspective, the pathological. It's too strong a word. Or maybe it just seemed, I suppose I've not been exposed to it. It just seemed bizarre, like particularly his thing that somehow he was going to hell, you know, because of premarital sex, something like that. I was like, wow. I know that that's prevalent in certain communities, but that came after hanging out with you and the school. And, you know, he's a teacher in San Francisco, kind of a lefty city, et cetera. It just seemed like, wow, that's intense. Where did that come from? So do you think it was like a strong, there's a mental illness thing there? Is there a strong religious thing there or any clue?
No, I mean, I don't think I would have moved forward with this project if I felt like it was a mental illness thing. I mean, I'm
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm as someone who suffers, I mean, true of most writers, right? As someone who suffers from depression, anxiety, like I would not go anywhere near something like that if I felt like it was a mental illness. I really think it was a fever pitch, you know, leading up to Trump's election. I think there was a lot of really divisive rhetoric. And I think, again, I mean, knowing what I know about my partner's family, like he was raised in a family that was wholly, you know, encouraging, supportive, loved me. Mm-hmm. You know, his parents had engaged in premarital sex, and that was something of a joke between all of us, right? Like, uh-huh. I don't know to what extent he became sort of radicalized. I couldn't understand it. And again, I mean, like you, I knew these people existed, but here I am in a relationship with someone and we're, you know, at that point we were together for several months before I really realized the extent. I mean, I felt like he hid a lot of his radical ideology from me because he knew it would be off-putting.
Oh, interesting.
I think that was what was so difficult, was by the time some of this was starting to become apparent to me, in retrospect, I should have jumped ship, but I would have jumped ship initially. In a lot of ways, it was this gradual reveal, and we'd been together and formed these memories, and there was such a strong bond between us in other ways that I started to sort of overlook these things. So I don't know where it came from. I think the insurrection on January 6th, I think so many of these things that we saw and we watch it and we think, how is this happening in our country right now? But that was part of it. I mean, he was very wrapped up in all of these things, and I was along for this ride, for better or worse.
And then both you and the main character, you know, the person you're talking about, Joy, in the book, and this unfolds over time too, and I don't want to reveal too much, people haven't read it, but, you know, both were subject to violence. So there's this kind of, though, if I got it right, yours is more emotional than physical, though there was this haunting quote from Margaret Atwood that you attributed, you know, men fear women will laugh at them. Women fear a man will kill her. It's a strong quote.
It's the most highlighted quote from the book. Every now and then I take a peek at, you know, how things are doing. And overwhelmingly, that's the passage that individuals who are reading highlight. And it's a true quote. It's an important quote.
Yeah. I looked at World Health Organization stats before getting on here, and it said 1 in 3 women, according to the World Health Organization globally, are subject, I think they're talking physical violence. Mm-hmm. It's mostly from partners. And one theme in the violence, according to the WHO, is religiously motivated, guided by this notion of sexual purity. So
you've got it. I mean, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in the language, the marketing language of this book, we refer to it as a silent epidemic. Mm. And I think that's absolutely spot on. It's not something we're talking about. You're right. It's 1 in 3 globally in this country. I mean, the statistics, you know, I've been looking at say 1 in 4 women will experience severe intimate partner violence in their lifetime. Mm. And then of course, you know, women who experience it are much more likely to find themselves in recurring abusive partnerships.
Pause for a second there. What's that about? Because there was a little bit of that, a little bit of thread in there. And I was just curious.
So I think there's a lot of things. I think the research shows that women who are raised or individuals, not uh-huh. even gender specific, individuals raised in abusive partnerships are much more likely to find themselves in abusive partnerships as adults. I think in some way it's modeling what is acceptable, what is...
It's like pattern recognition type of thing.
Totally. And you know, for me, I draw connections in this book to previous experiences that I've had around male violence. And overwhelmingly, I think there's this sense that you begin to, at least in my abusive partnership, you know, this is a person who really whittled me down to the point that I didn't feel like my suffering mattered. Mm. I think I was gaslit in a way that I didn't even believe that I was being abused. Mm. And to your point, I mean, I think writing this book has certainly opened my eyes to the staggering rates of physical intimate partner violence. But I think also the effect of, I mean, there are so many ways it's unpleasant, so many ways in which people abuse other people, psychological, mental, emotional. And even, I mean, what my partner was engaging with, I think in writing this book, I was so nervous because and I say this, he never outright hit me, right? Like he never hit me, but mm-hmm. he would physically intimidate me mm-hmm. into corners, physically intimidate me onto the floor, back me into spaces, use his body as a weapon. And, you know, I was so resistant because I think we tend to think in this hierarchical way of, well, he didn't hit me or strike me, and therefore it's not as bad as it could be, you know, and I think that this is, I mean, overwhelmingly physical intimidation is a form of physical abuse.
Right.
And that wasn't something that I was comfortable really thinking about
for
because
sure.
it seemed to talk about what I was experiencing inevitably minimized what other individuals are experiencing.
This wasn't on the internet stuff. As you got to know Joy, this was a big part of her life as well in both her significant relationships. But she ended up in kind of like a straight, an interesting place, you know, towards the, by the time you were with her.
That's right. So inevitably, you know, I meet Joy and we're in, you know, this intimate space of a truck cab driving yeah. up the Dalton Highway. You know, she told me if we hit perfect weather, it's going to be at least 14 hours until we get up there.
Yeah.
You know, if we hit anything, I mean, fog, ice, washout, whatever, it's going to be days. You know, Susan Orlean, the wonderful writer, talks about if you want a good interview with a subject, put them in a car because
yeah.
you have nothing to do but talk with one another, you know, with your guard down.
It's also this staring out into the horizon. People somehow,
yeah.
I noticed it with my kids, although they're teenagers, I would take them for long drives and they dropped like the biggest bombs when we were in the car because they're sort of staring off in the distance. So you're like, really?
Mm-hmm. And I wish that I could say that I knew this. I mean, the Susan Orlean quote, someone told me that quote a couple weeks ago in an interview. And I thought, well, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because we're, you know, we're riding in this truck cab and I'm, of course, like a dutiful writer. I've got my notebook out. I'm listening to her. And the first question I really wanted to get to is like, why? You know,
yeah.
why this road is, you know, overwhelmingly documented as the most dangerous road in America. Why in the world would you subject yourself to driving it? I mean, on average, she was driving it 2 to 3 times a week for 13 years.
Yep.
And again, it's an incredibly lonely job. It's just you in a truck for forever. There's one or two places along the way that you can stop and get a bite to eat and see someone else. But overwhelmingly, this is a road, you know, without Wi-Fi, without cell phone service, without rest stops, without police, without shoulders. I mean, not even painted lines. And then, of course, you're navigating Arctic Alaska, you know, these
right.
incredible mountain ranges.
Though a little bit maybe like the story chooses you, I would say the work chooses the people.
I think, yeah. I mean, and so again, it's like, why would you do this? You know, there's work in Fairbanks. It's not as if you live, you know, really off the grid or something. You have plenty of opportunities. And it really became a conversation that changed, right? At first, it's like, well, I love this place. This is where, for her, she's like, this is where I feel yep. most connected to my God, because there's no one else around. It's just me and him, which makes sense, right? It's a very pure landscape, except for the industrialization of the highway and the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Oh, it is. For listeners who haven't been up there, I mean, Alaska is, the other place I've experienced is also in Siberia, but it's the wildness of it is so palpable and the weather is changing radically all the time. And I found the people up there, they actually loved that.
Mm-hmm.
That if they were staying up there, they loved it. They loved the fact that they could walk out the door and go hunting. They loved the fact that it could be flat on the water and then there could be 12-foot waves. That unpredictability, a little bit the way I think some people are drawn to New York City, it seemed to have a different type of person, but it seemed to have that Alaska effect too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's kind of lovely as someone who, you know, I go up to Alaska and teach in Southeastern Alaska every summer at an arts camp. It's kind of great because the day and the climate kind of has ultimate control, you know, like
yeah.
you could think you're having a certain day and it changes and you've got to adjust your life accordingly. And there's something actually really freeing and lovely about that, that I think
yeah.
we're far removed from control.
Yep.
But as a result, you know, it became, I feel closest to God up here. And then it became, well, I make so much money doing this job that I'm able to afford, you know, I have the security that I need. And then of course, well, what does that mean? Right.
Mm.
There's a wonderful writer, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who visited my university a few years back. And he talked with my students about like, keep asking why, right?
Mm.
Like you see something happen. Why did that thing happen? Right. And why did that thing happen? And I think a lot of times writers and just, I think people in general, they only trace it back one or two whys.
Mm.
But ultimately, right, I have the money making, you know, doing this job, I have the money that I can provide for my daughter and myself if I need to leave the marriage, became a key part of our conversation. And so
safety.
safety, security, independence, you know, for Joy, she was in one marriage that was, you know, verbally abusive, emotionally abusive, very misogynistic and traditional in the sense that her husband didn't want her to work. He wanted her home cooking dinner and raising the babies. Right. And that was never who Joy was. I mean, she wanted to be in the Navy, and she was the first woman in Massachusetts at one of the Navy bases there, and prided right. herself on that. For her, it was, well, I had this experience in my first marriage that I know the value of being able to make my own way and care for my daughter, who is still a dependent. But increasingly it was, well, you've been in the second marriage for 20 years. How do you explain that? Right. And it was very quickly, the conversation became one of, I have my reasons, right? And the more I think that I opened up about what I was experiencing, because I had really never told anyone the extent of what was going on in my own home. Mm. The more that I confided to this person who, let's be honest, low stakes, this isn't a family member or a friend who's going to march into my life and, you know, right. do something about it. This is a stranger that I'm just talking with casually about what it means to be a woman. Mm. Increasingly, the more that I opened up about what I was experiencing at home, the more I think she felt out of necessity to tell me what her life looked like in the present.
There's also this strange thing that seems involuntary, and you probably pick it up in memoir a lot, which is that if you lower your guard, people lower their guard. And it's, I had one friend who was a very keen therapist, and he said his wife was sort of trying to take him inside the head of like an assessment of people. And it was like, her initial assessment was, can I eat you? Can you eat me? Could we reproduce? That was like the first like thing. And the letting down your guard is like, you're not in the category of I can eat you or you can eat me type of thing. And I found that when I shared my story, so many people were like, oh, okay, the family's really imperfect. And then people began like just gushing out, mm-hmm. you know, that you share your thing that she kind of lets you share. That makes total sense. It also seemed to me that Joy was searching a long time to find her mojo. In other words, she grows up in Arizona, then she's joining the military, and then she's kind of in this crappy marriage. It's like she has this strong sort of compass of what she wants, but not necessarily the emotional architecture to be able to clarify what it is. And by the time she gets it, I think the 14 hours on the road feel something closer to peace for her. Like nobody's messing with her there. She can't control nature, but she's got the truck and the dials and everything. I could understand the appeal of that.
Totally. You know, and I think it speaks to a larger cultural narrative. You know, I think Joy was in many ways living a bit ahead of her times, right? I mean, there was something that she said to me at one point about how women are better off alone. A lazy reader might read that and think that it's a book dismissing men. I think she was speaking to people more generally, not just women, but the idea that we live in a culture that really obsesses over partnership, you know, this traditional family structure. And for her, it had brought her overwhelmingly stress and pain and devastation. She talked about the value of her children and having these children with these partners, but you know, she really was someone who, what was driving her, when I look at her history and through what she's told me, was a passion to feel confident and in control of something, right? So in the Navy, she, you know, she had this position of authority that was important to her. Mm. After that, you know, she started working in a mine in Alaska, and, you know, her faith was important to her. So she took a job in a, you know, washing machinery, you know,
right.
But for her, I think she wanted to make the calls in life, and she didn't want to necessarily defer or water herself down for anyone.
Yeah.
That coupled with the fact that these long-term partnerships that she was a part of were abusive, I think speaks to this narrative of I think questioning at times what our culture tells us values and what we should all be striving for.
At least to my read, yes, that's true. And also a little bit of a blurry character in the sense that she gets to a better place with her second husband. It's very much under the sort of structure, I would say, of faith, but also seemed to be from, like, she has a very deep, for lack of a better word, maternal drive. In other words, in terms of her care, in terms of caring for her husband, so forgiving these types of things, people on the road, and even to the puppies. So it's both parts, it seemed to me.
Totally. I think you're absolutely right. And you know, maternal to me.
Oh, it's well said.
There were 20 years between us. When I think about what our time culminated in, at the end of the day, she's looking at me and saying, you know, you're looking at me as like this incredible figure of female strength, but look to me in some ways as a warning. You know, I'm 20 years older than you, but I have spent the better part of my life enduring abusive men because I think that I can see them through it, or they're going to change, or I can bring about that change through my constant love and presence and nurturing. And she said, you know, you're too young, get out. The last thing that I want to see is you 20 years from now at my age in the same situation that I'm in. You know, that's the kind of kindness and honesty that I needed from, again, from this person that owed me absolutely nothing.
And in that process, a little bit punctures the Instagram bubble. In other words, she said this one thing, I wrote it down. She said, everything Alaska has, you have back home, like in that grand sense. And I've always thought that that's a really powerful thing, because on Instagram, you can see these things of people walking on the edge of a mountain, feel like, oh, well, those human problems that you struggle with on this January day in freezing Connecticut are somehow absent there. Wrong. Like, they're inside you.
Yeah.
You just move and you carry them where they are. And I thought that that was kind of a well-placed statement she took. And the way to describe the story, she took time to sort of unfold that dart a little bit, if you will.
And I think too, she's speaking to like this idea of reinvention. I had traveled a lot at that point in my life. I'd been to Alaska before, but I think she was speaking to, you think you're going to come up to Alaska, learn something from me and go back as this totally changed, reinvented person. And Alaska's not going to do that. You need to do the work of changing your own life,
yeah.
Which again is complicated, especially when you're talking about leaving an abusive partnership. I'm, you know, really cognizant of the fact that I had a lot of resources to make that happen for myself, which is not true of so many women and individuals.
Right. Which is critical. Which gets to the money thing, yeah.
I mean, and there's no getting around the fact that, you know, as I was writing this book, overwhelmingly, it was thinking about things like, you know, this wonderful writer, Tressie McMillan Cottom, talks about like credibility itself as a form of currency that some women don't have. You know, they turn to police or they turn to friends or family and saying being abused and they're not believed. I was cognizant of the book of talking about that. I think it's crucially important. But for me, the idea was I'm not leaving this partnership because
right.
I am scared to reinvent. I don't know what that looks like, right? I knew that if I opened up to friends and family, you know, and if it came down to it, law enforcement, I would be believed. It was something that I thought I needed to stick around and endure, or I thought that I could change it. I don't know what I thought. Having her say, like, you've got to do the work. You've got to believe in the ability to reinvent
right.
what your
and
life
you said
looks
here,
like.
The problem is, I've been waiting for the hard work of changing me. Did something shift after this whole thing, or I don't know, maybe you don't want to discuss it or?
No, I think everything shifted. I think everything shifted. You know, this last conversation that Joy and I had in the truck before I flew home to Alaska was her saying, get out. Like, you think it gets better. It doesn't. It just gets worse. Like, obviously his behavior is mounting. It's escalating. I'd been skirting around that for forever. You know, it started with these condescending remarks about my faith or my value. Then it became picking apart my ideas or my life. Then it became, you know, verbal and emotional abuse. Then it was escalating to physical intimidation and backing me into spaces and scaring me to the point, you know, I wrote at one point, seizing, my whole body seizing with fear because I'm trapped in a corner and he's screaming at me. Things were escalating in a way that I was just beginning to come to terms with. And this last conversation she had was it doesn't get better. It only escalates. This is how it works. And so, you know, I flew home and I wish that it was something, you know, where I pull my shirt and it's a giant cape with a superwoman, you know, emblem and I get out of this relationship. It took a few days, it took a week or two, but ultimately it was a matter of like, I can't continue to do this. And I think to his credit, I think he was aware in the time that I was gone also, like this was not healthy. It was not sustainable. I mean, we had conversations where he said, I'm scared of my own behavior. You don't deserve it. And I know that pragmatically, realistically, right? And that's, if anything, that made me more endeared to him because
right.
I think like, oh, you've recognized
right.
that you're not treating me in a way that is appropriate. But then there would be these shifts. That relationship, yeah, the relationship really sort of dissolved abruptly and that was it. That was completely it. And I think with everything that happened in terms of Joy's life thereon after, I really believe I'm a completely different person and have a completely different life as a result of someone saying to me, you know, you're not
split.
Yeah. You're not stronger for enduring this. You know, you're not more powerful because you're dealing with this thing and you're, you know, managing it.
That's something, you know, my wife is a marriage and family therapy counselor. And one of the things that I've always believed that they don't teach you in school is basically what's the okay way to argue with your partner. My wife said, Everybody argues. It all depends how you do it. And first of all, for me, it was like, oh, everybody argues? Like, I know, like, that's not something you see on Instagram. Oh, I had a really terrible spat with my partner the other day, point one. But then the idea of what's the right way to do that and what's the wrong and learning how is friggin' critical.
Yeah.
And actually, in some ways, looking at it, Joy and her husband's first and second, and then you and your partner, and all of that, reading it, it was a little bit like nobody, none of the five people, had a really coherent framework for what's okay and what's not okay in having a disagreement with your spouse. And it was tragic in that sense.
Totally. And I would also say, I mean, one thing that promoting the book and, you know, leading up to its publication, I was writing a lot of sort of standalone pieces that we could place to generate some buzz around the book. And what was overwhelmingly clear was the way in which people sometimes get defensive about it. So in the sense that, like, I specifically wrote a couple pieces that came out the month of the book's release where I had editors and overwhelmingly they were usually men, although sometimes women, who would say, yeah, you know, are you sure that this was abuse and not just a fight? You know, and I've encountered that even in my own life where people say, are you sure it wasn't just an argument?
That's the worst.
As if I'm not a lived person who can differentiate between, I mean, I've had many arguments. I've yelled at people, they've yelled at me. I can tell the difference between an argument and what was abuse. And I think having to confront that, I've gotten used to it, but that immediate sense of, are you sure? And so I open the book with a quote from Rebecca Solnit about how countless women are being told that they are not reliable witnesses to their own worlds, that the truth is not their property now or ever. And for me, that was such a vital part because, you know, eventually I'm saying to people, this is an abusive partnership. And I think especially those who knew him were like, are you sure that you're not delusional and that he wasn't just mad at you? I don't understand culturally why we jump to that. I know there's a lot of discussion around the movement Believe Women, and we've done some really remarkable work as a nation in the last few years with Me Too. But this idea of are you sure that your perception of reality isn't crazy? I don't know why we jump to that. Especially with women, it's a gendered thing, I think, rather than listening to women and trusting that they know maybe the truth of their own experience.
Or maybe more broadly, just for any individual, it's like, if you feel something's off, it probably is. There's this kind of tragic end to the story, which is, you know, you've had this relationship, you've gotten the story, and then Joy dies. That changes the whole sort of trajectory of it in a way, because it's sort of, you know, Chekhov says that you could never escape, really. So while she's escaping, you know, in deep fog and trying to do the right navigation, she has this just absolutely terrifying end.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that drew me to Joy was the same thing that led in some way to this premature end. I mean, if you're talking about writing about someone who spends the majority of each week on the deadliest road in America, you know, there are risks there.
Yeah, the odds begin to work against you the longer you do it.
They do. And so, you know, we did this trip together in April of 2018. I flew home to Ohio. My relationship with my partner dissolved, and the plan was for me to come back up in September or October to do the trip with Joy again. For one, we wanted to see it in a different season. Two, I mean, I had basically a week's worth of content with her. That's not enough to write much of anything, you know?
Right.
The book was supposed to be, initially, it was going to be all about Joy. There would be no personal aspect. You know, both when I started it and even while I was traveling with Joy, there was no part in my mind that could conceive of I had a part in this story. I didn't see how, if I'm writing about this really strong, dynamic woman in Northern Alaska who's a trucker, where my experience would lend itself in any way to being a part of the book. And so Joy, you know, the plan was to come back September, October. I got the news on Instagram, of all places, that Joy had an accident on the highway. She was navigating through very dense fog, as you say, did exactly as she was trained to do, which is ride the shoulder, because you can't see if another truck is coming towards you. And it's often one lane in spots or incredibly narrow. And her tire bit into the tundra and flipped, and she was crushed instantly. In terms of the personal devastation, it's really hard to convey how much Joy meant to me and how deeply I felt that loss as a result of, you know, yes, it was a week physically together, but it was incredibly intimate. And we got incredibly close and continued to talk and text, you know, on an every other day sort of basis up until her death. But also, I mean, from if thinking only about the project, you know, I did not have by any means the amount of research and information and you know, lived experience alongside Joy to write about her only. But it also seemed clear to me that if we're talking about intimate partner violence and what brought Joy to that highway, my story had a role in the sense that I'm also presenting one way in public and enduring something else privately. And beyond that, I think the book, my hope is that the book speaks to, you know, the risks that so many individuals face on a daily basis that is in some way in lived response to the abuse that they are suffering. You know, Joy, the reason she was out on that road had everything to do with the experience in her own home. You know, moving forward with the book took time, and I couldn't conceive of how I would do it. One of the things I think about with the book is, yeah, it's not so much about trucking. Some people come to the book thinking it's going to be entirely about trucking in Northern Alaska. And in some ways, it begins as a seed of that, but it becomes a much larger conversation about intimate partner violence. And so those two stories began to sort of dovetail for me in the aftermath.
What's of the reader reaction? You've referred to this a little bit. What surprised you the most, and what you've gotten back from readers so far?
I have been utterly surprised by how many people have contacted me about how they related to aspects of either Joy's story or my story or both. I don't think I ever could have anticipated how many, for the most part, women, but also men have reached out to me having read the book. Men specifically coming from abusive partnerships who want to comment and kindly on the fact that they've experienced something very similar. And there's such a stigma in our society that we don't talk about, you know, men who are abused in partnerships. But overwhelmingly, I think just the number of people that relate to some aspect of this story, you know, Joy was very different from me in so many ways, as I said, and I did my best to kind of look at elements of her personality and mine and look at them objectively. And I think as a result, I think people are able to see some aspect of themselves in our stories. So that's been really profound.
That's beautiful. I mean, that's the power of a good story. There's another person we're having on the podcast. You know, we record them now that we sort of spelled about over season 4. There's a guy by the name of Jonathan York. He has this unbelievable book that I liked called Into the Woods. It's one of these classic structure of stories books, but it's also about why we tell stories. And he has a number of different explanations for why people have told stories for hundreds of years. In different degrees, they all kind of boil down to what's required for propagation of the species. And it has to do with like critical learnings you want to pass on. It has to do with love, finding a partner, the desire for kids. It has to do with being heroic. I think that this thing of taking people inside arguments, how awful people can be to one another, but how sort of unextinguishable the search is, I think, for the love. That's part of the propagation of the species. I mean, not to be too grandiose.
It's a beautiful way of describing his book. You should, I mean, truly attend all of his events for him. That sounds remarkable. That's such a beautiful endorsement.
Well, I'm saying it's in your story too.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about what that's, you know, at the deepest level, what it's about. It's kind of that thing. It's like, hey, we need partners and we want to have families and stuff like that. One of the things took me a long time to figure out what I was writing about in my book. And it was basically, I was like, there's actually conditions to unconditional love.
Yeah. Wow. It's absolutely true. And for me, it's, you know, as somebody not coming from a faith background, I would not believe the extent that, you know, here are two individuals, my partner and the subject, Joy Mother Trucker, who are both, you know, very into their faith, and, you know, just the difference between them. It's night and day. And I think that was really important for me. Yeah. One of the things that cracks me up is certain readers will say, like, this book was too preachy. It felt like a Christian book at times, which is hilarious to me because that, you know, I'm still an atheist. I think briefly there was this idea of, I agree with Joy that some aspect of our passing felt deeply important. I don't know how to explain how important it was that we met and how glad I am that we met. But it's really funny to me because it's in no way am I trying to preach a gospel. I just think it's really interesting to look at the way in which faith specifically manifested in the behavior of these two people.
Yeah, it's like a double-edged sword for some. The last question for me is I ask all, you don't have to, but all the guests we have here, I said, you want to ask me anything, because I always feel like after I've lobbed tons of questions, I want to give them the chance to return fire if they want it, but they don't need to if you have to run off and teach a class or anything.
Oh, I absolutely want to. I mean, I think as I was thinking about what I wanted to say today, having listened to previous episodes, I think all the time about if I could go back and tell my high school
you
self.
You listened to previous episodes of this?
Absolutely.
There, you're doing your homework.
Come on.
Fantastic.
You do your homework. You have to be prepared. I'm a teacher, so it's built in that you know what you're getting yourself into. You're ready. So that's my question for you. If you could go back to your high school self and tell that person one thing, what would it be?
It may sound banal, but it's true. But everybody's struggling. Everybody's struggling. There's a lot of smart people that are talented, blah, blah, blah. And someone's going to run faster than you or do better on this test and stuff like that. Like, we're trying to get through this together. And everybody's got their load to carry. And it's very different depending on the person. And it can really ripple through. And so this thing of looking at people around you and seeing that you're really not seeing much, that there's a lot under the surface, and that they're trying to find their way through. You know, the high school self, I was very much like, I'm wrestling with this and that and the other type of thing. A typical self-involved 18-year-old. But I think that if I could have sat myself down and say, hey, listen, buddy, don't think your stuff is so big. You know, look, this person, that person, that person, let me take you inside their lives a little bit. And, you know, for me, that came with age, but it's you know, really changed the way I look at the world.
I think that's really sage and wonderful. That's a wonderful thing to tell someone.
Thanks.
Thank you both so much. I appreciate it. You have a lovely Friday afternoon. Thanks for this.
You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.